This episode courtesy of Gretsch Drums and that great Gretsch sound. Visit GretschDrums.com to see the latest gear and sign up for the Gretsch newsletter.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are fucking all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about in this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in once in a while?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas, with Zuby.
What's going on?
Zuby, thanks for doing this today, man.
That's all good, man.
Now, I want to get into, off the bat, you have this interesting background as far as... You're a hip-hop guy.
Mm-hmm.
And how you got that going. It's like the business side of it, how you did it all. Could you tell the folks listening... Let's start with where you're from. I know that's also an interesting background.
Yeah, sure thing. So I was born in the UK. I grew up in Saudi Arabia. I moved over there when I was a baby. My parents worked there for, ended up being 20 years in total. So I was actually in the American school system in Saudi Arabia from kindergarten up until fifth grade. And then when I was 11 years old, I went to boarding school back in the UK. So I was living in Saudi Arabia for the next several years, but I was in England during term time. Did really well in school, got into Oxford University. I studied computer science there. When I was in my first year of university, I started rapping. Began just as a hobby, doing it for fun. And then within a year, I released my first album independently, which was called Commercial Underground. Totally independent album, like all my releases ever since have been. I've put out another 8 since then. And I just started out with my circle, friends, family. You know, I made 50 CDs to begin with. I sold all 50 in about a week. I took that money, went back, made another 100, sold 100, came back, eventually did a run of 1,000. And over the course of time, I actually ended up selling over 3,000 copies hand-to-hand of my first album. And so once people started buying my music and coming to my gigs, that set off the spark of, okay, this is something I can do as more than just a hobby. This is something I can make a business and potential career out of. So after I graduated from university, I took 1 year out and I did my music full-time for 1 year. And then after that, I had a job offer to go and work in London for a big multinational corporation out there. So I was actually a management consultant for 3 years and doing my music stuff on the side. And then in November 2011, I took the jump. I decided at the beginning of 2011 that by the end of the year, I wanted to be a full-time musician. And November 2011, I incorporated my company, COM Entertainment, in August 2011. And then November 2011, I was out. And from then on, I have been full-time independent, making a living from my music. And then over the course of the last few years, I've added some additional strings to the bow as well, including becoming an author, starting a podcast, doing public speaking, and various types of coaching. So it all started with the music, and now people know me for a lot of different things.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And we'll get into some of that, too, as well. Yeah, yeah. So let's just back up real quick.
Sure.
I got to ask what it's like growing up in Saudi Arabia.
I loved it, man. I had a great time. So my dad is a medical doctor. A lot of people ask, you know, why were you in Saudi? What took you over there? So he worked for a very big oil company, actually biggest one in the world. And so... we lived in an expat community. It was very international. People from all over America, Canada, UK, Europe, parts of Asia, other parts of the Middle East, Africa. I was surrounded by all sorts of people from the very beginning. So where I grew up, to be real, to be clear, it was like a kind of a bubble within Saudi Arabia. So there was kind of like this bubble of this community and similar communities like it. And then there's kind of the real Saudi Arabia. So if you're going out and, you know, you want to go shopping and you go to the mall or whatever, then you're going into real Saudi. So it was, you know, so there was a little distinction there. And Saudi is an interesting country in a lot of ways. It's a country that a lot of people have very strong feelings about, oftentimes not based on much real information. It's not somewhere that a lot of people have been to. So I often say that I think it's the most misunderstood country in the world, especially from a Western perspective, because some stuff is just different. A lot of stuff is different. But of course, when you grow up somewhere, you get used to the way things are. If someone is born and raised in Germany, then they default to the German way of doing things and certain cultural aspects, and perhaps even, you know, things within the law, things within the society, general norms. And I'm blessed to have been grown up in a way that I've experienced a lot of different ones. So I've had heavy exposure to, I'd say, four very different cultures from very early. So obviously I'm British by nationality. I'm also Nigerian. My parents are both originally from Nigeria. Our family is originally Nigerian by blood. I lived in Saudi Arabia, so I was out in the Middle East for 2 decades. And then also I was plugged into the American system for a large part. I mean, if you met me when I was, even now, people meet me now and think, more people think I'm American than think I'm British even.
Well, the accent.
Exactly. And that's from Saudi Arabia. And so it confuses people, right? So
if I tell my American accent from Saudi
exactly,
Arabia.
Exactly. So it confuses people whether they hear my music or they hear me speaking or whatever. Wait, is this guy British or is he American or is he, wait, oh, he grew up in Saudi Arabia, but is it, what this, what's this?
So how do you identify as they say these days?
You know, I'm a British, I'm British, I'm Nigerian, you know, I'm British by birth, Nigerian by blood. Culturally, I'm a combination of, I guess, British and American primarily, but also with other influences. And then in terms of where I grew up and where my home was as a child, that was Saudi Arabia. So I'm not, I'm certainly not Saudi. And I'm not culturally Saudi, and unfortunately I don't speak Arabic because I went to an American school there and they didn't teach the language, which is a shame. But I consider
myself...
You
never did pick up the language.
No, unfortunately not. No, it's a shame. I wish things had been a little bit different in that regard, because it would be a good language to know. But yeah, I consider myself a man of the, you know, I am a man of the world.
Anthony Quinn, I'm a citizen of the world.
Yeah, very much so. So yeah. There's certain places that I've spent a lot of time, and I know the countries well, and I understand the culture, and I've met a lot of people and so on. And then beyond these places, you know, I've also traveled to another, I think at this point, about 38 or so different countries. I've performed in a lot of different countries. I've spent time in different areas of the world. And so my perspective is pretty holistic. It's not black and white. I can see the pros and cons of different countries, different societies, different cultures, different ways of doing things. And so I think even with what I do in terms of my social commentary, a lot of people these days know me for just kind of someone who gives his perspective on the world, socio-political, cultural commentary, whatever they want to call it. And I think I often just have a different perspective from, say, someone born and raised in England or born and raised in America or whatever, because I've seen these different angles and different places. So my view is often maybe a bit less black and white. It's more like, okay, look, there's pros and cons to everything. There's strengths and weaknesses. There's criticisms and there's praise. There's things that different people in different places can learn from each other. And it's not just as simple as the way we do things is 100% right and everyone else is backwards, or and that goes in every direction of the thing. Because one thing you realize when you travel a lot is, number one, I think, you know, big things like most people everywhere are decent. And I think that's an important thing for people to know and understand, because I think oftentimes people can be, how would I put it?
judgmental.
Yeah, judgmental, but also, yeah, there's a lot of, there can be a lot of stereotyping and heavy bias, and also people can conflate, you know, here's a question I've been thinking about recently, which is like, what is a country, right? When you think of a country, is it literally the physical landmass? Is it the people? Is it the government? Is it the culture? So on. So I think it's a tricky question. I mean, and oftentimes people conflate things. So I think for example, I don't think most Americans would want America to be judged based on the worst actions now in historic of its government, right? I think American people are probably more critical of their own government than, you know, than outsiders even are. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be fair for someone to look at a country like the USA and point out all the bad things its government has done and does, and then say, okay, well, this, and then cast that shadow across the entire American people and say, well, this is America.
And
this
blame
is,
the citizens, this is, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
However, people do that with other countries, right? So you might have people in the West, in the UK or US, and they look at another country, whether it's in the Middle East or a part of Africa or somewhere, you know, more considered more foreign and more geographically far away, and they'll see certain actions that the government has done. They go, oh, well, that's that country. That's those people. And it's like, well, no, not really, because the people and the government are not one and the same thing. So that's just an idea I don't have all the answers. It's something I've just been kind of toying in my idea of like, okay, when someone says like, I love America, what does this, you know, I love the USA, what does that mean? You love the American people, you love the system, you love the geography and the way it looks. And I think maybe it means different things to different people. So I think it's just more complicated and nuanced,
yes,
than maybe people like to think. I think it's very easy to adopt this view of, you know, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys, what we do is good, what they do is bad, and it's that simple. And I'm like, it's not, you know, it's not. Are there things that are better in certain places of the world? Absolutely. Are there things that are worse in certain places? Absolutely do. And then even if every individual has a totally different experience, you know? I mean, I've had people ask me questions like, oh, you know, like, I don't know, someone might ask you a question, like, oh, what's the USA like? It's like, what do you mean? I mean, which,
it's a,
you
know, right? It's a big question.
Right? It's a huge country.
And this would be where in the UK, someone might ask you that.
Yeah, kind of, yeah, thing. Yeah. But people ask it, you know, even the UK is a much smaller country. The UK is smaller than Texas.
Yeah.
But even if someone says, you know, what's the UK like? It's like, well, which part of it? Where are you? Who are you? What's your experience? Like, you know, people will have a huge range of different ideas. Someone growing up in, I don't know, the inner city in the Bronx in New York, in not great conditions, might have a very different view of the USA to someone who, I don't know, grew up in Austin or in Dallas in a relatively affluent suburb, or someone who's there. And so it's complicated, but I think that's something that makes life interesting, and it's why I'm constantly trying to understand human beings. I'm constantly trying to understand myself, understand other people, understand the world, understand history, just understand why things are the way they are. And I think that's an infinite pool of exploration,
yeah,
that's been dived into for thousands and thousands of years, and there's still very big questions, mm-hmm, that we don't have concrete answers to.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very naturally inquisitive, and I like those kind of intellectual conversations. So I often engage in that publicly, both doing podcasts and interviews like this, but also just through what I do on social media or even in my music, just trying to throw ideas out there, start conversations, get people thinking. I think all of that is important.
Yeah, no, I get it. I mean, you said you went to Oxford.
Yeah.
So that
maybe is a factor.
One would have to be a little slightly inquisitive.
Yeah.
One question, your parents are from Nigeria. Do you speak Nigerian?
There is no such language as Nigerian. The common language in Nigeria is actually English. Nigeria has over 500 different languages.
See, folks, I did not know that.
There you go.
We,
yeah,
we all learned something new today.
You learned something new.
Unless you're listening and you didn't learn that.
Yeah.
You should do that.
Yeah, Nigeria is actually one of the most diverse both in terms of ethnicity and languages, countries.
So there's no official language or
English.
English is the official.
English is the common one. So there are lots of there are many different tribal languages. There are maybe about five or six major ones. And by the way, these are totally different languages. These are not.
They're not similar.
I don't mean dialects. No. I'm talking as different as English, Arabic, Chinese, and German.
Wow.
Like completely different. Not like, oh, I know this one, so I'll pick up stuff here. No.
Wow.
You'll have better luck picking up some Spanish and Italian as an English speaker. So my parents do speak the Igbo language, which Igbo is the tribe that we're from. That's in the southeast of Nigeria. I can understand a little. But I'm not great at it. Out of all my siblings, actually, I'm the one who speaks and understands the least, because I've never lived there either. So,
but your siblings have, is that?
Yeah, to at least for some time.
Right.
At least for some time. I'm the only one who never lived in Nigeria.
Have you been?
At all. I've been many times.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been there many times.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I mean it's where I'm from.
No, but that's what I'm asking. Like,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, it's a country with a lot of pros and cons. A lot of pros and cons. One thing I always think in Nigeria is it's got so much potential. It's really a country full of potential. And there are certain challenges and issues which, when and if they can be overcome. I mean, I think Nigeria is projected, like at the current state, I mean, I think Nigeria is projected to have the third biggest population in the world, perhaps, within a matter of decades.
Wow.
So Nigeria has it's the most populous country in Africa. I think it's already maybe the seventh or so most populous country in the world. The average age there, I believe, is 20.
Whoa.
Yeah, very young population.
Youth of today.
Yeah, young population. I mean, as you know, you probably have met, whatever country you go to, you'll meet Nigerian people. Nigerian people tend to travel a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of emphasis on education and entrepreneurship. And, you know, I mean, this in itself perhaps is one of the challenges the country faces, which is what people call brain drain, which is that so many capable, intelligent people in the country actually do end up leaving and moving to England or moving to Canada or moving
to New York.
Yeah, the U.S. In fact, I believe that outside of Nigeria, Texas has the biggest population of Nigerians.
Is it the entire state or is it in pockets? Like,
I think Houston is, I think it leans quite heavily towards Houston, but I believe, don't quote me on this, but I think certainly one of the biggest concentrations and populations of Nigerians outside of Nigeria is actually in Texas.
Interesting.
Which is interesting. Yeah, so we're scattered all over the place.
Well, what's it like culturally as far as the music, let's say. Let's take that for example.
Yeah, well, interestingly, Nigerian music has really blown up internationally in the past decade or so. So what people call Afrobeats, which used to be more limited to Nigeria and a few other countries in Africa, is like blowing up in USA, UK, like all over the West. I mean, you go to clubs, you go to certain events, parties. You hear a lot of it, but Nigeria's always produced a lot of musicians. It's always produced a lot of musicians, and I believe that a lot of
great drummers.
Mm-hmm. And I also think a lot of musicians, a lot of black musicians in who are from other, you know, who are American or British, etc., are of Nigerian descent, mm-hmm. as well. If you were to trace it back. So there's a rich culture of music in general. When I go to the country, you just out and about, there's a lot of music, a lot of dancing actually in various, even in times where from a Western perspective it might even be strange. So even like a funeral, for example, there's music and there's dancing, and which I think from a Western perspective, like a Western funeral, like having people dancing.
Well, I mean, so, Irish. Have you,
is that Irish? Okay, well, there we go. Maybe I'm being too broad. Okay, well, okay. Maybe
Irish cry at weddings.
Oh, okay, okay.
And party during a funeral. There you go. Celebrate the
yeah,
life.
In fact, maybe I'm being too broad by saying Western here. Maybe it's more like...
No, I know what you mean. You're not... No. You're okay. It's okay. Yeah. I know what you mean, and yeah, that's why I'm saying it's known as like more of an Irish thing. It's not really...
Yeah, that's interesting. So, again, this is why these conversations are so interesting, because you can see every little culture.
They celebrate the life.
Exactly.
Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, no, it's the exact same in Nigeria. So, but just various events, there's a lot of music, a lot of dancing. It's just something that's more common. Say if I compare it to, like, in England, right, where... people don't even generally like dancing unless they've drunk a lot of alcohol. in general,
right.
People are more happy and willing to dance, and it forms more of a part of the community spirit in certain aspects of the culture and tradition.
Yeah, and is hip hop a thing?
Hip hop is a thing. There are. There are well-known rappers in Nigeria. Have been for
You say. By the way, you say rappers, and I keep saying hip hop.
It's fine.
Like, do you prefer one over the other?
No. To me, they're just. There's a huge overlap, and they're slightly different things. To me, in the words of KRS-One, right? You know, rap is something you do. Hip hop is something you live. Hip hop is like the overall culture, which would then include breakdancing, graffiti, DJing, as well as rap. So, like, rap is an element of hip hop. Rap is the music of hip-hop, but I think when people say hip-hop, it's more like the culture, but I don't care. I use them fairly interchangeably. If someone calls me a rapper or a hip-hop artist, I'm not there, like, correcting them or something. It's like, yeah, I'm both.
Got it.
Yeah, I'm both.
it's a little bit... I've asked this on the show, people from England, and I've said, like, you know, it's very difficult for someone like me to understand the difference of what it means to say England, the United Kingdom...
Oh, okay.
Written.
Yes.
And they've all kind of been, it's nuance, it's...
Do you know, they probably don't know either.
Well, I get that it also matters about territories and it's what actually, you're really saying.
It's actually quite simple. I can explain
please,
it if you want to
know. Please
do. Okay, sure. So, Great Britain is the main island. Great Britain is the name of the island, which consists of England, Wales, and Scotland.
Okay.
The UK is Great Britain plus Northern Ireland. So the UK is four countries. Great Britain is three countries.
Okay.
And England is just one, is the biggest country in Great Britain. So you've got England, to the north you have Scotland, to the west you have Wales. So England is that country, and then England is part of Great Britain, and Great Britain is part of the United Kingdom.
So it's Great Britain, it's not just Britain, or Britain is the same as Great Britain.
Yeah, Great Britain is the full name. Kind of like,
okay,
this is the United States of America, but lazily some people will just say America.
So if someone is from, we'll call it the Big Island, just for fun.
Okay.
Just for fun, like Hawaii. They could just say, I'm from England, and they would leave it at that.
Well, they assuming they're not Scottish or Welsh.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what
I'm saying. If you're from England, you'd say I'm English. If you're from Scotland.
Right.
Any of them could say they're from the UK, or they're British. And they'd be correct.
The safe... Is it, like, the more politically correct answer?
There isn't one. It's a matter of precision. It's a matter of precision. So, if I say I'm from the UK, that could be one of four countries.
You could be from Scotland.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? If I say I'm British, that could be one of three countries. It means I'm not Northern Irish.
right.
But if I then say I'm English, I'm specifically saying I'm from England. If someone says they're Scottish, they're from Scotland, they're Welsh, they're from Wales.
Okay.
So.
Now, your folks moved from Nigeria to...
Saudi Arabia.
No, but they didn't... Oh. I mean, to Great Britain.
Yeah, England, yeah.
England.
Great Britain, England.
Where did they move to?
They're in the South Coast.
No, but they went from Nigeria. Were they married in Nigeria? In other words,
they
met in Nigeria.
Yeah,
and then moved to the South.
Yeah. So it's a little complicated because before I was born, my parents spent time in the UK as well. Like, they were between Nigeria and the UK prior to moving to Saudi Arabia.
For studies?
Yeah. My dad did a lot of his, I think he did his primary degree in Nigeria, but then did some further studying and examinations in the UK. So they were back and forth between those two countries anyway. And then the Saudi Arabia piece came in. And then, right. we all moved out there. So I'm one of five kids. So, you know, family of seven immediately. And so that's where we, that's where I grew up. So all my first memories are in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, no, I get that. And you're saying culturally, you're getting this American thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? I mean,
yeah, that was from growing up in Saudi. So when I was in Saudi Arabia, I was basically, it's called an international school,
mm-hmm.
but I was basically in an American school.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my teachers were American. A lot of the kids were American. Not all. Not in fact, maybe probably about half.
Because there's others like you. They come from different,
yep,
right?
All over the world. But mm-hmm. the curriculum was lifted from the American schooling system. It was all grades, you know, kindergarten, first grade, second
right.
grade. So that's
right.
not how you communicate. That's not the language you use in England, for
sure.
example.
Sure,
right? You know, you talk in England, it's year one, year two, year three, and so on. So I left that when I was 11. So after fifth grade, mm-hmm. I left. And then I went into the UK. I would have gone in at what, I guess, year eight, I think it would be called in British terms. So I switched school systems. So I suddenly went from being in essentially an American school to being in a, you know, private British boarding school, wearing a uniform and having to wear a tie, and everything being a little different, and being surrounded by all these kids with totally different accents.
I was gonna say, you were the kid with the American
accent. Oh yeah, yeah, I still am.
Never really, but you can do it, right? I mean, you can.
The British one. Yeah. So here's a funny thing. When I went to the UK when I was 11, one of my goals was not to lose my accent.
Lose your American accent.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I liked it.
Interesting.
And I didn't want to lose it. So I'm the only person in my family with this accent.
They all have British accent?
I don't know what my parents have, really. But
okay, that's fair. But
yeah, but like...
Your siblings?
For the most part, yeah. Yeah.
But you can do it, right? Like, if you need to turn it on. No, you know what I mean.
I could, but I'd feel silly.
You've never done that?
Oh, once in a while, of course. It's fun.
I mean, and what I'm saying, and you would fool them, no?
I could do it, but it would feel very forced on my part.
Well, do you hear it? Like, when an American is faking it, do you hear it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it doesn't happen.
Okay, so like the actors, when they try to pull
it. Oh, if they're a good actor, then...
So you've heard it done well?
Some actors can do it convincing.
American actors?
Yeah. Yeah, I can't think. I'm struggling to now think, like, off the top of my head of a good example.
Great Gwyneth Paltrow.
I think people can be fairly convincing. People can be fairly convincing.
Spinal Tap. I don't know if you've ever seen Spinal Tap.
I have not seen Spinal Tap.
Yeah, all right. Now, wait a minute. So, what was going on culturally, though, in Saudi Arabia, like, musically speaking,
Not much.
Well, I mean, even just in American school, do you remember anything? Like, what were the kids into?
So here's a funny thing. I wasn't into music myself until I was about 11 years old.
Okay.
I didn't like music as a kid.
I didn't like music, no. Like, turn it off, I don't want to hear this.
No, I was really particular. Maybe I still am. I didn't like music, and I didn't like television that had real people in it. I only liked animated stuff. I didn't watch anything that wasn't animated. I didn't watch anything non-animated until I was maybe 10 years old. I wasn't interested.
Okay, well, I mean, that may not be so strange for a kid. I mean, that's fair.
Yeah, I was very particular with it as well. And then, I didn't like music, which is funny because I also played piano. I played piano as a kid.
How old were you when you started that?
Maybe seven or so.
Do you still
six
play?
Six or seven. Unfortunately not. I stopped playing when I was about 14.
Okay.
When I was in boarding school, I got to a level where I wasn't going to get any better unless I put a lot of time and practice into it. And I just had other things that I was more interested in at the time. And it wasn't something that I really wanted to prioritize. And to be fair to myself, I didn't want to waste my parents' money. I was very conscious of the fact, maybe this is...
You were thinking like that?
Yeah, right? I think maybe this is relatively rare as a kid, is that I knew my parents were paying additional money for my piano lessons, and I felt bad if I were if I wasn't practicing in between lessons.
Wow.
And I'm wasting their money because I'm not going to really progress otherwise. So for both of those reasons, I decided to stop. By this time, you know, I really got into playing rugby, and it was just being in boarding school. It was just busy. It was a lot of stuff going on.
Was it co-ed or was it...
My first school, I went for 2 years to an all-boys school.
Yeah, so it's rough and tumble and you just...
And then for another 5 years, I went to a co-ed school.
Right.
Although the ratios were really screwed. It was like 3 boys to 1 girl.
Oh, so that's...
That brought its own drama, as you can imagine. But
that's its own study, right? Am I right? I mean, right? It's like...
Yeah. It would have been great if it was inverse. Actually, it probably would have been dangerous if it was inverse, so...
So music wasn't a thing. You were more of a jock, as we'd say, right?
No, not at all.
Oh, because you mentioned rugby. I mean, that's...
I've never been a jock type. So... In Saudi, I was known for drawing. I was an artist.
Okay.
I wanted to be a cartoonist when I was a kid.
Okay.
That was my dream.
Okay.
So I used to just draw. Anyone who knew me as a child would be like, oh, Zuby's still drawing, right? Like, that's what I used to do. I used to draw. I used to create my own cartoons. Mm-hmm. I was always, I found school, to be honest. I'm not trying to sound cocky, but school was very easy for me. So I would just blaze through all my work.
Oh, and you were that guy.
I was that guy.
Oh.
Yeah.
You never had to work. You never had to study.
I did, but
things like math just because I came to you easy. Is
like I wanted to get 100% in everything, and I often did. So I was that annoying kid who was like, yeah.
But things came easy to you, like I said, like math, for example.
Yeah.
Well, these are gifts.
Yeah. It is definitely so. So I would just sit there drawing all day.
Right.
I was always drawing. So
right. The
creative dimension, even though I wasn't into music, the creative dimension was there from very, very early on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I became a music fan actually when I went to school, when I went to boarding school. That's when I became a music fan. That's when I became a hip-hop fan.
What grabbed you first?
Oh, boy. In terms of specific artists, so this was like when Eminem started blowing up. Eminem, Dre, Ice Cube, Nas, Jay-Z, I want to say those are some of the first artists that I, myself and my friends really got into and started listening to. And then a little bit later on, when I was in my secondary school years, more in my early to mid-teens, that was the whole like 50 Cent and G-Unit era, and you had what else, like Dipset was blowing up at that time. I wasn't personally a huge fan, but I got really into like Jay-Z, Tupac as well, Tupac, Biggie, what else, I got really into LL Cool J. That was like a dope time of music, actually.
Really, yes, really. I was going to say, do you end up going backwards or not really?
In what way?
Well, for example, like I grew up listening to, I guess, mostly rock, we'll say, as a young guy, you know? And what you do is, or what I did, and what a lot of guys do, is like, so you get into the Rolling Stones, let's say, and then you discover, oh, they were influenced by these old blues guys.
Yeah.
And so you start researching that, and you start going backwards. Mm-hmm. Is that a thing in the hip-hop world?
Most certainly.
Did you do that? Did you go backwards and go back to, like, Grandmaster Flash?
I didn't. Generally, I can't say I've listened to a lot of Grandmaster Flash, but right. I went back and, you know, bought some albums from, you know, Rakim.
Right. Eric B. and Rakim, right.
Yeah,
right.
Public Enemy,
mm-hmm.
Big Daddy Kane, Kool G Rap, that kind, yeah.
Yeah.
LL Cool J, as I already mentioned, those type of artists. So not the earliest hip-hop, maybe from, like, the 70s,
mm-hmm.
but... late 80s, early 90s,
mm-hmm.
that was my old school. Just like mm-hmm. for kids now, 50 Cent, Jay-Z, Nas, Eminem is old school, right?
It's true. Kids are listening to Eminem. You're right.
Yeah, that's old school to them. But for me, those aforementioned artists were more like old school, KRS-One,
mm-hmm.
Who I've actually met a couple times. So for me, that was like my old school That was my old school hip hop. And to be honest, a large percent of the music I still listen to is from like the 2000s and maybe early 2010s. That's still kind of my favorite era of hip hop for me personally. I think for most people, what was really popular and what they were listening to in their perhaps between the ages of 15 and 25 tends to be what they stick with for the rest of their life as their favorite, as their favorite era in music. That's a pattern I've noticed, regardless of people's ages. If you can find, okay, between that decade period, what was big then, and that tends to be...
It's a comfort food.
Yeah.
Right? Like you put it on, and it's like, oh yeah, it's an old friend.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, you'll listen to some older stuff, you listen to some newer stuff, but it's like, man, nothing quite beats that era.
Because it's what you listen to 1,000 times, if not 10,000 million times. So you start. You're just doing it. What, like singing along? I say singing, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You're just kind of starting off like that, and it's just a private thing, is that?
Yeah, so, okay, so the way I started rapping, funnily enough, was...
Because you said you were in Oxford University.
I was, yeah.
When you... Okay.
So I think... Let me trace this back properly. So after my first term of university, I actually was going to Nigeria for a vacation. And I got somehow... I had a layover in Paris... and something happened with the flight, and I was basically stuck in the airport in Paris for about a day.
Charles de Gaulle.
That's right. And there wasn't much going on. I didn't have much with me. I did have my MP3 player at the time, and I had a pen and some paper, and I started listening to some beats, and I just started jotting down some lyrics to pass the time. And it came to me surprisingly naturally. I'd never tried writing my own lyrics before. Of course, I'd rapped along to my favorite songs. So I guess I knew I could sort of rap. You know, I could mimic it. And then I started writing my own stuff. And then while I was out in Nigeria during that vacation, I kept doing it. I had quite a bit of downtime. And I kept writing lyrics. And I, you know, recorded into... Just record acapellas into... My player and share it with my family. You know, some of my cousins were around. I was just like, hey man, look, I made this little rap. What do you think of this? Just little 16 bar verses. And
what kind of stuff were you talking about back then?
It was pretty deep. It was pretty similar in line with what I talk about now. Just observing the world and what I'm seeing going on. Talking a little bit about my aspirations. Some of it just, you know, it's rap, so you know, sometimes just I'm dope, rapping about how dope you are or whatever. And so I started doing that, and I got positive feedback, which of course, you know, you take with a grain of salt because it's friends and family. But then when I came back to university, one of my friends, Chris, actually had a basic recording set up in his dorm room, and from his previous stuff he'd done with bands, he knew how to record. Like I don't know the technical ins and outs. So I don't know if you remember. Do you remember the website SoundClick.com?
That rings a bell.
Yeah. SoundClick was the one kind of prior to SoundCloud, where a lot of producers would upload their beats, and they had charts and stuff like that.
So
Independent artists would use it as well for their own songs, but it was really good for beats. So I'd go on there and I'd get beats off of the internet from these different producers around the world. There's one beat I downloaded called The Bad Man, produced by a Canadian producer, and I made a song called The Bad Man with it. So that was my very first song. And so I made that. I also uploaded it to the SoundClick website, but I just was showing, this is when I was in university, so I was showing it to my friends and playing around. People were like, man, like this is pretty dope, man. Like this is cool. So that gave me, I guess, the kind of encouragement and validation. I was like, all right, cool. Like this is something I'm going to do. I made another track. Second song I made was called Oh No. Third song I made was called Tonight. And then I actually burned a CD with those three songs on and did some basic artwork, and that was actually like my demo. And there was a magazine in Oxford called Night Shift Music Magazine, which is still going, by the way, one of the longest running magazines in the city, maybe even in the country in terms of music. And they gave me demo of the month. So, and they were actually quite a critical magazine. It wasn't, yeah. it wasn't one where it was like they praised everything.
Right.
So they were like, okay, this, you know, this, you know, don't get it twisted from this, you know, this, you might see Zuby and say, oh, this guy's from, here, he's from Oxford University, but he's got some bars, you know, he's saying some stuff. So,
right.
So I put that out there and that was cool. And then, the next two songs I made, actually, I made a song called Before, Tell Me Why, and then I made another song called Step Into Me. And Step Into Me was my first song that got attention. So I sent it to BBC Introducing Radio. So BBC Introducing in Oxford, they really liked the song, and they would play it most Saturdays on their show. And then I also, you know, I burned it on CDs and I would give it to DJs and stuff. And sometimes, you know, DJs would, because they'd be during their set. Sometimes I'd literally give it to them while they're playing their set and they'd give it a shot and, you know, maybe play like 90 seconds
right. And
see how it goes down. You know, do people stop dancing or do they keep going? And so, the song did a little bit of damage. And then I shot a music video for it, which was shot in Oxford University. You can still go on YouTube and type in Zuby Step Into Me and you'll find it. You'll see me looking very beardless and youthful. And so the song got, there was a channel at the time in the UK called Channel U, which used to play underground, primarily homegrown British hip hop and grime music videos. And I sent it to them and they put it on their playlist. So I then had a music video getting national airplay. Wow. Not like all the time, but, you know, on this one channel, it was there. A couple radio stations were playing it and stuff. And so I started to build up a name, not like a huge one, but people were like, okay. And I think also I had an interesting USP being an Oxford University computer science student who's also doing this rap thing. And so within the city, within the university, a lot of people got to know my name. That's also when I made my I'm Down With Zuby RU t-shirts, the black t-shirt with white text. And I made one just for myself to begin with, and then my friends wanted them, and then eventually I started selling them. So I had lots of people at my university wearing these black t-shirts with my logo on them.
Got the merch going.
Yeah, I got the merch going. And then, as I said, in my second year of university, when I was 19, I made my first album. It was called Commercial Underground. So it had Step Into Me on it, it had Before, Tell Me Why, and it had another six songs on there.
Self-produced.
Yeah, though not produced in terms of the beats, but
you had someone to help him.
Yeah. I don't make beats.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I don't make beats, period. Gotcha. I still don't. I don't know how to make a beat.
Was it the friend with the setup in his dorm?
I recorded it with him. Mm-hmm. He mixed it. But the beats were primarily from SoundClick.
I
leased them from different producers.
Well, hold on. Just to back up real quick. What was the plan when you went to Oxford? You knew you wanted to get into computer science. Is that?
I didn't know.
Okay.
I mean, I was 18. I went to Oxford at 18 and graduated at 20. So I didn't necessarily.
It was just like a cultural background thing because of your family, because of your parents. It was like sort of.
I mean, I knew I was going to go to university.
You sound like an Indian guy. I don't mean.
There's a lot of parallels.
But it's like, you're going to be. You can be anything you want in this world. You can be a doctor, or a lawyer, right? You can be whatever you want.
Props to my parents.
Doctor or a lawyer.
Props to my parents. They were never like that.
But
so that
wasn't necessarily okay. So just to clarify, that was not in your family culture where they were insisting you must go to school.
You must go to school, but it was never you must be a doctor or an accountant.
But you did. But education was key.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Strongly.
Right. So did you have any plan at 18?
At 18, not really, man.
Okay.
Not really. I knew I'd go to university. I mean, I had the grades to go to.
Yeah.
One of the best universities.
That's pretty sick.
One of the top universities. So
I think you're the first guy on the show who's been to Oxford.
That's, okay, cool.
Yeah, I think.
So it was kind of a no-brainer to go, even if I wasn't sure what exactly. I, to be honest, I think in general, asking an 18-year-old what to do with her, it's a little bit of a tall order, I think.
Please.
So
they're lost.
Yeah.
Lost.
Yeah. So for me, it was like, all right, you know, computers. I am interested in computers and technology and stuff like that. So it seemed like, and I'm good at math and science. So I was like, all right, I'll do computer science. That makes more sense than, I don't know, English or history or philosophy.
And what did that even mean
like that.
There?
Computer science?
Yeah, when you start studying that. What does that mean?
In Oxford, it's very mathematical, actually. It's a degree that varies quite a bit depending on the university you go to. So for me, it was a lot of math, especially in the first year, like calculus and linear algebra and differential equations and stuff. I don't really know why. But then also various types of programming, procedural programming, functional programming.
Learn how to code.
Object-oriented programming. Yeah.
I learned for example? How to code.
Yeah. But I think in a place like Oxford, which is very academic, it was their philosophy around the computer science course was preparing you rather than just like, okay, you just are going to learn C, or you're just going to learn C++, or you're going to learn JavaScript, whatever it is. It was more like, we'll give you the tools so that whatever languages are thrown at you in the future, you'll be able to quickly adapt and be able to use them. So straight up, I wasn't a huge fan of my degree. I didn't love it. I also didn't excel at it like I'd excelled in pretty much everything else I'd ever done. Mm-hmm. Funny story, my first exam, which was not an important one, it was like a mock exam, but the first exam I ever did in Oxford, I got 14%. 1-4. So this is me coming off of getting like 95 to 100% in pretty much everything my entire life. And then my first exam there, I got 14. And so that was a very humbling moment.
Was it depressing? Was it?
I wouldn't go that far. But it was like, oh, okay.
I like that. I wouldn't go that far.
No.
Like Zuby doesn't do depressed.
No, I don't. I really don't. Not even sure what it means. But
you didn't really get knocked down from that.
No.
Shook it off.
Yeah, it was more humbling. I was like, okay, all right, this place is serious, right? You hear about Oxford, like, okay, you know.
They scored a face shot. You sort of went, okay, all right.
Yeah, I was all like, right. But it was a great experience, man. It was also cool to be surrounded by one of the great things about universities like Oxford and, you know, certainly in the UK, Oxford and Cambridge, those are the top two, is actually, there's a lot of power in being surrounded by really, really smart people.
Yeah.
All the time, right?
Yeah.
Like, it does make you just step up in everything, and I guess all the conversations that you're having with people and all that, you're just in an environment where thinking and conversation and debate and problem solving is very important. And you're surrounded by people who also share that with you. I mean, it's hard to get into those universities. It's very hard.
Yeah.
And it's not like something, a misconception I found actually, especially in the US, that people have about there is money, you can't buy your, there's no buying your way in.
No,
there's you can't. Some people think, oh, if you're rich, mm-hmm. you can go to Oxford. It's like, mm-hmm. no, like money doesn't matter. It's purely competency.
Right.
And those are also the only universities in the country, I think maybe with the exception of UCL, which do interviews to get in. So I had to do six interviews to get into Oxford, which is more than most people. Most people, it's two or three. I had six. So that was like actually
the most...
What's
up with that? What do we tie that to? Do we have any ideas?
Just them trying to get the best, brightest minds from around the world.
They're just not sure. They're like, we think he's the guy, but after the third one, after the fourth one...
Well, the thing is, so most universities, it's just grades. So in the UK, you do what are called A-levels, or now it's AS and A2. So most people do three subjects. So you pick three subjects, it's graded from, what's the worst grade? I guess you can get a U to an A. So you do, you pick three subjects. Some people do four, I did four. I did chemistry, biology, maths, and economics. And to get into the top tier of British universities, you typically need the top tier, you need three A's. Just below that, two A's and a B is pretty standard. So if you want to go to Oxford or Cambridge, you need three A's. So everyone applying has got three A's or four A's. Some people even have five A's. And so everyone's, they're all straight A students.
Yeah.
And then the interviews are to,
okay. The creme de la creme, baby.
Yeah, so out of all these straight A students, yeah. We need another filtering process to make sure we get the best people.
Wow.
So that's what it is. With it, or every other university, it's like, okay, you got three A's, you're in.
But are these interviews, these six interviews with different people?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it one-on-one always?
Worse. Some were three-on-one.
Oof.
This is when I'm 17, too. Like, it's rough. It was actually, like, in hindsight.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I'm like, dude, that was savage.
Yeah.
Like, they were serious. It was, like, three-on-one.
With the glasses on the tip of the nose.
Yeah.
Just kind of checking
Yeah, I mean, you're 17 years old. You're sitting there. And, and by the way, these interviews are not, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Or, you know, tell us about a time you overcame a difficult circumstance.
What is it?
These interviews are, how many sides and vertices does a four-dimensional cube have?
Oh.
Stand up on the board and draw us a graph of, you know, of y equals so and so, right? Like, they want, like, you have to show your mathematical and problem solving skills. They give you problems to solve and work through.
But you understood this stuff.
Yeah.
Would you, were there
not easily? I mean, it was.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
No, for real. No, that's for real. Yeah. Like, are there moments where you're saying, oh, no, I can't do, I don't know?
Well, they want to see you work through it. They want to see how your brain works. So I literally got asked that question. How many sides and vertices does a four-dimensional cube have?
Did you know what that meant?
No.
Okay.
I was like, wait, what's a four-dimensional cube? Like, what does that mean?
Right.
And they were like, okay, so imagine you have a square, and then you extrapolate it in a third dimension for it to become a cube.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, I'm with you so far.
Yeah, so you have like a flat square, and if you pulled it across a third dimension, you get a cube.
Okay.
So they're like, so it conceptualize you have a cube and you expand it across another dimension, how many sides and vertices would it have?
What's a vertice?
Vertice is like a point. So a cube has 8 vertices.
Oh, yeah.
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 So,
yeah. But, yeah, I was not the guy who got 95s and 100s.
But yeah, so it's stuff like
my this, listeners
so,
know that. But
yeah. So it was rough. It was like, whoa, okay. But they want to see
how you work through it.
Yeah, how you work through it. So you're supposed to kind of think out loud, and you can ask them. You can ask them questions. You're like, okay, you know, what about this or what about that? But that's what they want to. That's
you
really
figured
what
it
they
out.
Want to see. Yeah. And I, of course, this is for applying for computer science. So someone who's applying for history or physics or philosophy, like they'll be getting a whole different type of question.
Well, that's what's interesting too over there is that idea of, and this is, I guess, in Europe, that where you're choosing a major right away.
Mm. Oh yeah, because it's not like that here, is it?
No. I mean, I didn't go to college, but okay. I mean, here that's not a thing. I don't.
Mm. Well, here, I mean, people pick a. I think
well, they can.
I think what happens in the UK, I think the subjects you do narrow earlier, right? So you know how when you're young, you're just learning everything. The curriculum is absolutely everything. And then in the UK, they want you to start specializing by like 15, 16. So like I told you for my A-levels. So from the age of 16... the only subjects I did were chemistry, biology, maths, economics. Everything else was gone by then. Those were the only 4 subjects I did from 16. And then for most people, that narrows further.
Yeah.
Most people after 1 year will drop one more so that they're left with 3. I decided to keep all 4. And then after that, you pick one. And that's the one you study at university. So actually, it narrows perhaps a little bit too early. Maybe, I don't know, I guess there's an advantage in that maybe you specialize further, but as we were saying, I think in hindsight, at that young age, it's probably a little too narrow a curriculum.
Hmm.
And maybe an advantage of, say, the American system is that the scope stays a little broader and wider at that age, and you're not immediately narrowed down to just doing one subject and, you know, deciding essentially at 18, like, okay, this is the one subject I'm putting all my chips on.
Right. People can if they really know. There are people here clearly in high school know they want to be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But as we established already, that's extremely rare for an 18-year-old to
It happens.
Know.
I think it's a minority.
It's a minority,
Minority. And
plus, most people end up going to university, majoring in something, and then not going into...
Look at me.
Right.
Yeah, so...
That's the norm.
That is the norm. But the way I look at it as well is... Because I do get people who are like, why did you go to Oxford? Or why did you finish your degree if you're not going to use it or you end up doing something different? And I often use the line that going to university is to open doors, not close them, right? Just because someone has a history degree, why can't you be a chef with a history degree? Why can't you be a
It's the connections you make. I mean, do you still keep in touch with a lot of
absolutely.
People?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And are these high-powered people?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Every single one. All my friends are successful.
Every single one that
all
you went
them.
To?
Yeah. Yeah.
High level.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious.
In
totally
different fields as well, right?
Yeah.
Engineering, banking.
No, I get, but they're like masters of the universe now, right?
One of my friends just won an Academy Award. So yeah, we're all doing like totally different things in totally different fields.
Wow.
But, you know, everyone's obviously smart.
Upper echelon.
Also, yeah. Hardworking, ambitious people. And that's cool. You know, I mean, my thoughts on university have changed quite a lot since this time for a whole host of reasons. Not for everybody, but I don't think most people should go to university. And I think it's silly for society to push most people to. I actually think it's a really bad and outdated way of doing things. And I think especially, I mean, again, here's another difference in the U.S. is it's more expensive here.
Yeah.
Right? It's more expensive here. So in the U.K., I think maybe the average, I don't know what the average debt is, but I want to say it's maybe in the region of 20,000 to 30,000 pounds. Someone might correct me and I might be wrong on this. Whereas I think here you're, you know, six figure debts are not rare. And by the way, in the UK, this has changed quite a lot. So when I was in university, I think the average annual tuition fee was about £3,000 a year. So that's under $5,000 a year.
Whoa.
By the way, when my older siblings were in university, it was zero.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was it was taxpayer.
Mm-hmm.
It was taxpayer funded. So, and then I think now it's $9,000 or $10,000 a year. So just for me leaving, it's gone from $3,000 to $10,000 in terms of the tuition fees. And then prior to that, it was zero. So I'm not going to say that it was free because nothing is free, but it was taxpayer publicly funded. So the math has changed a lot, and the value of a degree has changed a lot. And then also depending on what you study. So I think there are some people, it's a no-brainer. You should go to university. You know, you want to be a doctor, you want to be a surgeon, you want to be an engineer, whatever, right? I'm not going to tell you just do a course on YouTube or something. It's like, you know, right? Like there's certain people where it's like you're doing this certain course, you want to do this.
I have discussed this on the show and broke this down. The idea of I've seen the guys who've gone to music schools, University of Miami, Berkeley, et cetera. A lot of it is the connections.
Yes.
Back to that that they've made.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're all in the same business. And, oh, yeah, I know him from school. And that alone, I even have to admit, can be extremely helpful.
It can.
For, you know, certain, like, guys who go to Wharton School of Business.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
Yep. And also, the thing is, I'd say, the thing is now as well, you can build those connections without university now. So the general, the tools have changed. I mean, the amount of education that's now available for free or cheap online now versus even in 2002, totally different ballgame. Price of university and college has shot way up.
Yeah.
The value of a degree in itself, in terms of real value, has gone down. So it's gotten more expensive, but less valuable. Mm. There's new alternatives. that have popped up. If you want to talk about networking and making connections, hey, you know, you've got Twitter, you've got Instagram, you've got YouTube, like the amount of people all around the world, you know, the connections I've made through Twitter are more powerful than my Oxford University connections.
Interesting.
Right?
Interesting.
So,
yeah, because you got people reaching out to, I'm sure.
Of course.
That we all know.
Yeah.
And they're hush hush. Right?
So, well, not all of them are hush hush, but
some are, right?
Sure. So, you know, we're in this new era, and I think a lot of people are, and I think a lot of parents even are still in this old mode of thinking of, you know, oh, absolutely, of course, our kids must go to university. And that's now something that I really challenge. And I say this as someone who went to university and is very pro-education in general. But I think too many people conflate the words education and college, or education and schooling even. Mm. Right? I often say education is cheap, college is expensive. And nice. They're not the same thing.
There's a new t-shirt.
That is a t-shirt. But it's not the same thing, right? You can be very educated and very smart, wise, knowledgeable, and whatever, and, you know, not even finish high school, let alone go to university. That is absolutely possible. We've got top entrepreneurs and CEOs and business and whatever in all different sectors who are not graduates.
Sure.
And then also you have a lot of people with degrees who are dumb.
You
have plenty of people with degrees, but they have no common sense. They can't hold a conversation. No. They maybe even the degree they studied is just something ridiculous and silly. You know, they spent 4 years majoring in gender studies or in some pointless
Romanian basket weave.
It's just like, well, that's not helping. If anything, that's a hindrance, and it's also put you in all this debt.
Right.
I think when it comes to just like with many other things, I think we've been through, and people in music really know this, because I think music was one of the first things to go through the digitization process, moving from primarily physical realm, both in terms of creation and in terms of distribution and consumption. Music was the first thing, you know, you of course remember the Napster era and all, like, music was the first thing to get digitized and go through this, this internet thing has really destabilized it, smashed a lot of traditional ways of doing things, also introduced new opportunities and ways of doing things. Photography went through that maybe around the same time. So various things are going through that. I think education is one that's also gonna go through this. And
what does that mean? Homeschooling and virtual learning?
It's already going up.
No, but is that where you're heading?
Yeah, they're rising. But I'll tell you what needs to, the one piece of power I think the universities still really, really have is the accreditation. The accreditation. A lot of people will say, well, I have to go to college because, you know, these jobs, these employers demand you have a degree.
Yeah.
But again, that's really a filter. So I think if there could be a cheaper online university where the accreditation is just as valued or similarly valued to that piece of paper showing you went to Oxford or Harvard or Yale or whatever it is, I think once that accreditation piece is fixed, and this will take time, then, because at the moment, you know, you can do an online course, but you don't get that like stamp of approval that said tells people, you know, like, look, I don't really use my degree day to day much, but just me saying I have a degree from Oxford University, it's got power. It's got flow. If I ever did want to go into a more normal career, which I don't, then that still has, it's still got power. It's got name brand recognition. It's just got something to it. It's got this cachet, which is powerful.
Yeah, it's a blue chip stock. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and I don't think there is yet any online equivalent to that, right? There's no online university or course where it's, oh, wow, you're qualified in this, But I think eventually there will be where someone can say, whether they're in the field of music or business or medicine, there'll be something saying,
I would
agree
with that. Okay. It seems inevitable. You're right.
Yeah, I think so. I think that'll happen eventually, and the whole thing will become far less expensive. And possibly the and this will also force the universities to step it up as well. If they want to keep their thing going, they'll have to rise to this challenge. I think it's more of a, it'll open it up, it'll make it a bit more free market. I think.
You said you did a 4-year degree in 2 years, is that
what? A 3-year degree. 3 years.
Yeah. How does that get done? Just
I did a 3-year degree in 3 years, but because yeah, so
all right, I misunderstood that.
No, it's all good. So I think because
you said 18 and 20, that's why I thought.
Yeah, it's because I'm an August birthday.
Oh,
so I'm one of those people who's always been at the one of the youngest people.
Interesting. Yeah.
In my grade, you know, there was always that August September divide.
Yeah.
Because of that, I graduated before my 21st birthday. So I graduated when I was 20.
Gotcha.
Even though I started when I was 18.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Now I understand.
Yeah.
Now, so you are at this point, like you said, are you gigging at Oxford? Are you doing...
At Oxford?
Yeah. Are you actually doing gigs, or is it no more of like you're just making CDs, passing them around?
Oh, yeah, I was gigging. Sorry. When you said now, I thought you meant like now. I was like, huh?
What?
Yeah, I was doing shows.
You were?
Yeah. My very first gig ever was actually in Saudi. My very first gig. I performed in there was like a golf clubhouse, which was like a community center kind of thing where occasionally they did events, and I actually performed at one of those.
You flew over for this?
I was living there.
Okay.
So this is outside of term time. So during term time, I was in England.
Okay.
Outside of term time, summers, Christmas holidays, Easter, I was back in Saudi.
Because your folks are still there.
Yeah. So I performed there. Tons of my friends are still there. Because most of my friends didn't... I went to boarding school early.
Right.
So at this time, all my friends were still in Saudi. They stayed until ninth grade, and then most of them went to boarding school. So I came back, I did a performance for maybe about 150 people, and that was my first ever live performance.
Was that just you and a laptop? How does that work?
It was me and a laptop.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of my friends, Garrett. God bless him, was like kind of my hype man. So that
you gotta have the hype man.
Yeah, so that was like my first ever live performance. And that went well, that was fun. And then when I came back to Oxford, I started doing some shows locally.
And at this point, are you saying to yourself, this is what it's gonna be, or you still don't know?
I'm kind of testing the viability, I guess. Because I think in music especially, I think in any creative endeavor, there's a significant gap, and it's a much bigger gap than I think people think between hobby and career. And I think actually a lot of musicians and creative people make the mistake of thinking the gap between those things is smaller than it is, because they take they take different mindsets. And a lot of musicians are not entrepreneurial and don't have business minds. And if you want to, especially independently, if you do want to make a career of it, you get a lot of creative types. They kind of feel like, ugh, like they don't like to talk business and money and like marketing and
advertising. I'm an artist, man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I get that.
Yeah,
I get that.
Yeah.
But if you refuse to do that, then you're gonna struggle to cross that gap. Thankfully for me, I've got both of those heads. I have the creative mind and entrepreneurial mind as well. And I don't have that, starving artist mentality of like, you know, like I gotta, you know, stay in the, like, I can't sell my art, or I can't. He was like, nah, I was there. I would wear my t-shirts all the time. I've always been happy to self-promote, go out there on the street, tell people about my music, pass out flyers, sell my CDs, do what I have to do to keep some income coming in, but also to make people know who I am. You know, one thing I still get criticized for, something I've been criticized all the way through, is self-promoting too much.
Really?
Yeah, Zuby self-promotes too much, right? He wears his own hats.
Right.
He wears
his
own t-shirts. He's always, you know, Zuby this, Zuby that. And I'm like, well, who should do it? Right? Like, right? Like, if I don't do it, like, this is the thing. Like, people think, I don't know, like, I have some team or machine behind. It's like, it's just me. Yeah. And it's always been just me. So if I don't have the confidence to go out there and promote myself and say, hey, look, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing, and I believe in what I'm doing, then why would anyone take me seriously? If I'm ashamed to wear my own t-shirt or my own hat, why on earth would someone else wear a Zuby hat? And so it's the same with what I do now on social media. It's like, oh, he's trying to build his following. It's like, yeah, I am trying to build my following. Like, you're correct. You know, like, is that supposed to be a bad, like, that's what I'm, that's what
busted.
I'm here for.
Yes,
yeah.
I am.
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
You know, I'm not trying to, I believe in what I'm putting out there. I believe in my message. I believe in my music. I think I have something positive to offer the world. So,
but you get a lot of pushback, and that's the way it goes.
Sure.
And that's the way it goes, right? You put your head on the chopping block. And
that's fine.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You know, you have to be willing to take the good with the bad. And the good so much outweighs the bad that, you know, I get asked all the time as, how do you deal with hate? How do you deal with criticism? No one ever asks, how do you deal with all the love? I get 50 times more love than I get any type of hate or criticism. Right. And it's like, and maybe that's harder. You know, if someone's just sniping at you or, you know, it's like, whatever. You know, for me anyway, like after all these years, it's like, no, whatever.
It just rolls
off. Yeah, it rolls off. But I think actually it's harder and to deal with, whoa, okay, like, how do you deal with the positivity and love and attention.
You mean watch the ego, watch the head inflation.
Watch the ego, but also kind of balance out the, especially in this day and age with social media, the line between fans, friends, supporters, acquaintances, it's so blurry and everyone can reach you, everyone can access you. People know who you are.
And they think they know you.
Yes. People know who you are, but you don't necessarily know who they are. And
well, I can relate to that because of this. Again, people just think, well, I've heard you for so many hours.
There you go. And people might confide in you.
I feel like I know you. Yeah. I feel like,
And people want to tell you their stories and confide in you. And you know, sometimes it's cool, but sometimes you're like, whoa, like this is a bit, this is a lot. Like I don't, you know, or people are in certain situations and it's crazy. Like I'm the person you DM or email. Yeah. I've had people, I don't know, they're having some issue with their family or some big issue with their life or whatever, and they want my advice.
Right.
And I'm kind of like, man, like this is not what my, this isn't what I'm.
I'm not a therapist.
I'm not really a priest.
I'm not a.
Yeah, like I'm flattered you value and respect me so much that I'm the person you think you can confide in this, but also this is really not my, like I don't know you, man. Like this is really not my thing, and also I can't do this for thousands and thousands of people on a one by one individual basis. So there are new challenges that sort of that come with it all, but. Overall, man, like just the way everything's been going over the past few years, like I said, you know, I put out my first album in 2006, and I think that's something a lot of people also don't realize, because most people who know me discovered me in the past 3 years, which is fine.
But yeah, overnight success, and then
right. But it also means that people think, oh, you just started with. There's people who are just like, oh, he just.
You're new. You're a new guy.
Uh-huh,
exactly.
Uh-huh, yeah. Or people discredit even, right? Some people are like, oh, you know, he just got on Joe Rogan, and you know, after he went on Joe Rogan, like, you know, things blew up, and it's like there was a lot that happened before I got on Joe Rogan.
Well,
you know, like there was a 13-year period between me putting out my first release and me appearing on the Joe Rogan Experience for the first time. He didn't discover me out of nowhere, so there's a lot that goes into it all. But I think with all these things, you have to be able to take everything with a grain of salt. Both the praise and the criticism and the love and the hate, you have to take everything with a grain of salt to stay humble, but also not allow yourself to be have your confidence or your self-belief shattered because you're seeing these mean things people are saying about you or the criticism and whatever, and you decide, oh, you know, I can't handle all this. So there's a really healthy balance, I think, to stay grounded and stay sane, but stay motivated, stay sticking to your guns, putting out the message that you believe in, stay creative, stay doing what you do. And I think actually the downfall of a lot of people in general, but I think maybe especially in the world of creativity and musicians, is not being able to do that. Either letting the ego completely get blown out of, you know, just become a complete diva and start being an a-hole to your fans and start thinking, you know, you're this and that and you're not even like a normal human being anymore. And I think that can mess up a lot of people, or when, you know, people getting involved in all kinds of crazy stuff, just so much excess. I think that's taken out a lot of artists. And I think also the opposite, just not being able to deal with a certain level of scrutiny and criticism and backlash and doubt, and they say all that, they let it completely get all to their heart and end up falling into, you know, depressions or, you know, overdosing, or if, you know, people can be, you know, intentionally committing suicide or all those kind of things, which are more common, actually, far more common in the world of music than perhaps any other sector. And that's not something that's talked about a lot,
because they're sensitive.
Sensitive people. Yeah, exactly. And there's a pro and a con with that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You're doing mostly the music thing, but you, like you said, you have so many, you got the books.
Yeah.
You're entrepreneurial. Mm. But is there a plan, a long-term plan? Do you think like that, or, and then you don't want to talk about it?
I can talk. So my goal, and this is why I was so drawn to becoming a rapper in the first place, is to have a positive impact and influence and inspire and motivate as many people as I can through my words and my actions. So I knew that when I was a management consultant, you know, sitting in my suit and tie, working in an office, I knew, you know, I could make a good living here, but I can't make a positive dent in the world, really, in a way that's going to be memorable and people are going to be like, hey, you know, that person helped me or inspired me or whatever. So I've always wanted to use my voice to put out a positive message and to inspire and encourage other people. And I used to do that just through my music, and that was my sole vehicle for it. And then as time went on, I thought... So, I mean, some of it was a little bit random in terms of the things that started getting attention and so on. But also I just thought, okay, well, I can still do music, but I can also do other things. Music isn't the only thing. It's not the only talent I have. I'm a good speaker. You know, I'm a thinker. I have ideas that people are interested in. So yeah, I can do a podcast. I can start my own podcast. I can appear on other people's podcasts. Mm-hmm. I can do public speaking. If people want to book me to speak at a college or a university or an event, I can do that. I'm really into fitness. A lot of people ask me for nutrition advice and training advice. In fact, I've been going to the gym longer than I've been rapping.
Right. Fully jacksonated,
exactly. So I'm already doing all this.
Yeah.
So, hey, why don't I write a book? You know, why don't I write a book that can help people, whether they're...
I was going to say, so when it comes to the coaching thing, I mean, that's what I mean. You can be doing it for the entrepreneurial side, mm-hmm. you can do it for the music side, the fitness side,
yeah.
Diet.
Yeah. So the through line between it all is wanting to help motivate and inspire other people. That's the through line through everything. The fitness, the music, the speaking, the coaching. For me, that's the through line. As a creative, as an entrepreneur. So all that's happened is like that goal and vision has stayed the same, but it's bringing more pieces of arsenal out to be able to do that. And also just accepting that it's okay if people primarily like or value one or just a couple parts of what I do. So mm-hmm. there's plenty of people who are fans mm-hmm. of me mm-hmm. who haven't heard my music. Mm-hmm. And at first that used to annoy me mm-hmm. when this sort of transition started happening. And then I thought, you know what, that's fine. That's okay. Rap and hip hop, it's not everyone's cup of tea. But if you, but I really like your podcast, awesome.
Yeah.
Right? As long I can put something into the world out that you like and you value, if it's that one, great. If it's that one, great. Like, I'm just happy you're here. And something interesting that happens as well is there's this cross-pollination where someone might discover you through one thing.
Right.
But then they find your, someone might buy my fitness book. And they're like, hey, well, let me check out his music. Cool, actually, I like his music. Someone hears my music and they're like, oh, what's going on here? Someone discovers, sees one of my tweets going viral. Mm-hmm. And they're like, wow, this guy's an interesting thinker. Let me listen to his podcast. So however people discover me, whatever it's like a buffet, right? To take what you want. I'm not offended if you, you know, I like the chicken, right? But you know, if you'd rather have the salad or the, you know, then that that's cool too. If you want a little bit of everything, that's fine. I'm just happy that you're here.
I love that, the cafeteria style analogy. Are you planning on touring? Is that something you'd like to be doing? Like,
I would love to. Yeah, I did a few independent tours in the UK, which I self-organized. I did one in 2012, one in 2013, and one in 2018. And I've performed in a few other countries as well, especially in Europe, like, you know, Germany, Estonia, Czech Republic. So now I actually have a US visa. So I can perform in the US now, which was not an option before.
Yeah.
So this is all new and early. So I don't yet have something I can announce, but in the future, certainly I look forward to being able to do both one-off shows and eventually some type of tour.
So can you live here?
I can live here now, yeah.
With no restraints, no...
Yeah, no, I can live here.
You can just live here if you want.
Yeah, I can live here, yeah.
Are you thinking about that?
I am, most certainly, yeah.
Are you leaning towards Texas?
I am.
Good
Texas,
man.
Texas and Tennessee.
Good man.
Are my top ones. Austin, Dallas, and Nashville. Are currently my top three cities.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
why not have them all in a way, right?
Yeah, maybe so.
Is
maybe
that what you're kind of thinking too? Like maybe
I'll see, man. Like I'm at an interesting stage in my life right now, both personally and professionally, where I'm just not tied to anywhere. People keep asking me like, where do you live? Where are you based? And I'm like, I don't know right now. I'm in this transition.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So
we'll. We'll see, but
you kind of like
exciting.
It that way, right?
I do. I don't think I'd want to be in this position forever, but while I'm here,
do you see yourself settling down someday as having a family? Do you
absolutely.
See that?
Absolutely, yeah, 100%.
But you feel like you've got a lot of time. Is that your thinking?
Well, I think firstly, it's only in the last couple years where it's been a consideration from. So I think. And maybe I think this is one of those things that broadly will apply more to men than to women. But as a man, you want to get certain things in place before you really think about, you know, getting married or bringing kids into the world or whatever it is. And because of the path I've taken, that has taken longer and been more of a bumpy road. Say if I just stayed in my corporate job. By my late 20s, I probably would have been like, okay, cool. Like, things are, here's where I live. It's stable. I've got this, I've got that. That's my salary.
Right.
Cool. Like, I'm ready to hit that next stage. As a musician and a creative and an entrepreneur, I mean, like, I left my job in 2011. I took a pay cut for 6-7 years. Here's an interesting thing. 2019 was the first year where I made more money than I used to in my old job. And I think it's important for people to realize
that. And that's
that.
From, like, since 2006.
2011. Sorry. So, from grinding since 2006, yeah.
Yeah.
And 2020 was the first year where I made, like, significantly more than I would have in that year if I'd stayed at my old job. So it's only recent where it's like, okay, cool. Like, I've actually got a solid income and money in the bank, and I kind of know what I'm doing. I don't have a house yet. Anyone, FYI, you know, we're recording this interview in a car park.
By the way, we are in the mobile recording unit.
We're in the mobile recording unit. Yeah. So
the fans listening, the original.
Yeah. So I'm things are not stable in terms of location and geography and stuff like that. But at least financially, I'm at a stage now. I'm like, cool. Like, I'm good. Like, I'm good.
Right.
And that is new. That's new for such a long period.
Yeah, but you've got it. There's a nomad in you. Mm-hmm. You have that spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Which helps as a musician as well. Back to that. Mm-hmm. It helps. Mm-hmm. You're going to hit the road. And
Yeah. So in terms of any type of settling, it's only, like I said, it's in the last couple of years where it's like, okay, cool. Like, that's actually something viable that wouldn't just be too chaotic. Or also for any woman involved in the picture, you know, me just being like all over, completely all over the place and like this and that.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, that has to happen organically.
Exactly, exactly.
I mean, we all understand that.
Yeah,
you don't just decide. You could.
Yeah, yeah. You.
I mean, one can do that. That's an option.
I kind of think it's
You'd make a good mother. You know? Let's go.
Let's go.
You know?
But I think even if you're going to do that as deliberately, you want to have a few things in place so that you're not...
Contracts.
Starting. And, so you're not, well, so you're not starting like completely on the back foot. You know? People do it all kinds of different ways.
You would like to do it the traditional way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I got you. I got you. There's time, man.
Yeah, man.
You're a young man.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm good.
No, you have time. I mean...
Yeah, yeah.
God damn it. These guys, some of these guys, man, they're... Look at David Foster. Well, he's not maybe being a father now. But so would you think, would you consider getting a band? Is that your kind of thing? Or would you think, nah, you stick
probably
to
Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. Maybe just a solid
DJ. Be cheaper. Make more money not paying a band.
Solid DJ. Maybe a drummer.
Yeah.
I've worked with drummers in the past. And just before the whole, you know, pandemic situation and shutdowns and stuff hit, I'd actually brought on board a drummer for live gigs, and then like for 2 years, like everything just, you know,
wasn't able to do.
So I think my ideal setup would probably be like me, a DJ, and a dope drummer.
Yeah,
I like that setup. I don't think, when it comes to hip hop, I think with a few, only with a few exceptions, I'm not sold on live bands always adding that much to it. Honestly, I think if the beats that the rapper uses are more live instrument oriented to begin with in their studio recordings, then it lends itself well. A great, most obvious example would be like the Roots.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I think with, I don't know, if 50 Cent had a band or Eminem had a band, I don't think it would. You can't really recreate the instrumentation that well.
Mm-hmm.
There's just types of instrumentation which are heavily synthesized, mm-hmm. and certain types of hip hop beat makers make, where, like, you can throw a guitar in there, but it doesn't really work because it's not a guitar beat. I think drums kind of work on everything.
Yeah.
So that's my thinking, and then I think also, yeah, I wasn't even really thinking that much of the logistics and the costs, but. That's another factor.
Less people to pay out.
Yeah, that's a factor.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, seriously, it's financially better for you. So this could be home base for a bit.
It could be, man. It could be. We'll
interesting.
See. Yeah,
interesting.
We'll see.
Real quick, want to add, you set a record.
I did.
Yeah, you want to talk about that?
I broke the British women's deadlift and bench press records back in 2019. As far as I'm aware, I'm still the record holder.
You heard that right, folks.
Yes.
The women's.
Yes, yeah. I identified as a woman for a brief period of time, and gained a lot of international fame and acclaim for this feat. And it went much further than I anticipated.
Hey, man, they set the rules, and you just said,
"I just
okay.
play by them." I just play by them.
Is this what we're doing? Fine, then I am. I'm a woman.
Yep.
And here's my watch my deadlift.
Yep.
Is this in the books?
It's on Google. I think if you type in British women's deadlift record, my name is still the first thing that comes up.
Have you gotten a lot of hate for that?
No.
Really?
No. What hate for what? Like, what's the... What?
Just that kind of... Like, you're being a wise ass. This is... What you did was, you know, you're just... You didn't get that?
Well, what can they say?
That, I mean, again, I'm on your side, but, you know, mm-hmm. but just saying, like...
But what would someone on the other side say?
That you're being cynical and you're using...
How do you know?
What's that?
How do you know?
Well, we don't know. That's the beauty. See, that's why I like what you did.
There you go.
See, I'm with you again, because I love that you can just twist it and just say, well, how do you know?
Oh, yeah.
You can't get inside my head.
Exactly.
I identified as a woman for that... Period.
Yeah. For someone who'd want to criticize me if I said that, I don't know, that Caitlyn Jenner is not a real...
Right.
They'd be the first to say that I'm being cynical and bigoted.
Well, that's the beauty. Exactly.
The rule is, hey, it's whatever you individually identify as. And by the way, you don't have to be consistent with it, because there's this concept of gender fluidity.
Right.
Which means that on this Tuesday, you might identify as male, but there's nothing meaning on Thursday.
Or even Tuesday night.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You could, you know, switch how you identify. So, you know, you can be fluid. And I'm not the one who made up these rules. I've just listened to them and listened to the arguments and said, okay, if that's what it is.
You've set the ground rules. I'll play.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Brilliant, man. No, I'm actually fascinated that, like I said, I just figured you'd get a lot of hate.
And you're like, no. I think it was very much a checkmate maneuver in that
there
isn't really anything.
Checkmate maneuver.
Right? Yes. Like, there's not really something someone can say without then they'd be being hypocritical. If they say, hey, that's not a real woman.
Because then they're being non-inclusive.
They're by their own rules.
Right.
They're being bigoted, right? But if they say, hey, that is a real woman, then I actually am the British women's deadlift record. So it's pick one. Either I hold the record or, hey, that's a man. that doesn't count. It's one of the two. It can't be anything else.
Brilliant, man. Yeah. So people can, just real quick, they can hire you, as we're saying, for coaching.
Yeah, I do coaching. I don't take on a ton of people, and I do charge a fair bit. But you can reach me at zuby@zubymusic.com if you wanted to inquire about that. I have helped a lot of people. And if you want to find me on all social media, I'm at Zuby Music, Z-U-B-Y Music, and zubymusic.com has links to all my stuff.
Zuby, I'm really glad we got to do this today, man.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Thank you.